People and the dogs that bring them together. This is episode number 7. My name is Bill, and you're tied to the Woe Post. If you're a breeder that wants to give your puppy buyers the best hunting dogs possible, you need to be genetic testing. And if you are genetic testing, you should be using Embark. They test for more conditions, they have more genetic markers, and they're the only ones testing for coefficient of inbreeding, which really matters for those of us with rare breeds and a small population of breeding stock. If you're interested, there's an affiliate link in the description. I don't know about you, but I'm planning to head to the Grouse Woods this fall. If you want to go, but you're not sure where to start, contact my friend Jake at Superior Upland. If you listened to episode number 5, you got to know Jake a little bit. If you didn't listen to it, then listen to this episode, then go ahead and back and listen to episode number 5. Jake will take you to the deepest, darkest, most remote public lands where no one else wants to go in search of rough grouse and woodcock. Last fall, he ranged on the low end 24 flushes and on the high end 45 flushes per day. I know I can't say that about my hunts. And if you're not up for all that, maybe you just want an easy hunt with family or a new hunter. You can hunt pen-raised pheasants, chucker, or quail on his preserve. And when Jake's not guiding, he's training dogs. Check out his puppy development program or the summer conditioning program for the preseason tune-up. For more info, go to superioruplandllc.com. I'd like to thank each of you for listening and for your continued support. The best way that you could support the podcast is to subscribe, download, and share the podcast with your friends. Or, if you want to support it even more, head on over to patreon.com/thewoepost and become a patron. As always, you can contact me at Facebook or Instagram at The Woe Post, or by email, bill@thewoepost.com. Last week on The Woe Post, I spoke with Tim Otto, NAVDA president. This kicked off a series where I'll highlight each of the versatile breeds by interviewing some of the best breeders, trainers, and handlers that breed has to offer. We'll start with the breeds that originate from the United Kingdom, then move to the continental breeds. This week, we're talking about the English Setter. The English Setter's history goes back as far as 1872 in, of course, England. Males can range in size from 25.5 to 27 inches, and females from 24 to 25.5 inches. Their tails are long and feathery. They typically have a flat lying and short coat, but can also have a thick and somewhat wavy coat. Their coat colors can vary from blue Belton to orange Belton and tricolor, and even some liver and white. They have a sweet temperament and are known to be absolute sweethearts and very cooperative. They tend to be big running dogs and used to be very popular in trials in England. They tend to hunt at a fast pace. Some can kind of slow down a little bit for you. And at least in the United States, they're a best choice for grouse or woodcock hunting. There are 3 notable types of English setters. Llewellyn setters are fast, wide-running dogs that tend to be on the small side. Ryman setters are larger dogs known to be cover dogs. And then there are old hemlock setters developed by the famous George Bird Evans to be a dual type of setter. If you haven't already met him, I'd like to introduce you to Scott Berg of Berg Brothers Setters. Scott and his brother Ben have been breeding, training, trialing, and hunting over setters for over 30 years. They've produced some of the most notable trialing setters, as well as hundreds of great hunting dogs. Scott is also the creator of Setters Unlimited, an online resource designed to pair puppy buyers with the best setter breeders in the U.S. Scott, thanks for being on the show. How are you?
Good. Happy to be here.
Can you get into a little bit about the history of the English setter?
Well, it's, you know, of course, it's an old breed, and the modern day dog is, you know, fairly different than what it was a couple hundred years ago. And today we have, and I don't know if this was true, you know, a couple hundred years ago, I kind of doubt it. There's a great deal of variation within the breed. You know, people have different ideas of what the breed should look like. Most commonly, people would break it down as you've got the typical field dog, right? You know, from field trial ancestry, and like any other breed, the field trial dogs influence the hunting dogs. They're not the same dog. They're just the ancestors of, well, actually, there are plenty of people that use dogs directly from field trial champions to hunt.
Sure.
But generally speaking, you know, there's a selection process where a little bit different type of dog is selected by hunters. But within the English setter breed, even within the field setters themselves, there's significant variation in the size. You may find, you know, 60-pound males, and you may find literally 30-pound females. There's that much variation. In the what is typically called the dual dog, it's kind of a combination of a bench dog and a field dog. They're generally known to be a bigger dog, and they are. You know, a 50-pound female is not at all uncommon, and a 70-pound male is pretty common in the bench dogs, but they're they're actually quite different physically and by design. As the guys who are breeding the field dogs, especially the trial type dogs, are looking for a significantly different degree of athleticism. Or the dual dogs, a lot of those breeders are, you know, purposefully want a slower moving, real easy to handle, you know, type dog. And then, and I'm, of course, being quite generic here, but the third type of dog that is, you know, most commonly recognized is the Llewellyn. And Llewellyn is, it gets way blown out of proportion. It's just a line of English setters. It just happened to be the line 125 years ago that was the dominant field trial line. If you go way, way back in the history, they'll talk about the days where, you know, they threw nets over dogs, and therefore they had dogs that, you know, pointed real low and that sort of thing. The modern day dog, there are some people that still like that, but the real aficionados, the people that, you know, have several dogs, the kind of guys that, you know, hunt a lot, and which is a lot of our clientele, they're looking for a lofty, very stylish, regal looking dog on point. And that is, at least by that portion of the public, considered a dog that stands real proud, real tall, and a dog that, you know, like if it lays down on point, that would be totally frowned upon. That if you were in a field trial, that would get you picked up. You'd be disqualified. They'd just tell you, well, we're not going to look at that dog, pick it up. So
Scott, can you tell us about what makes a setter a setter?
There's some distinct differences between, say, the dogs from hound descent, the German dogs, which tend to trail more, you know, run with a lower head, ground scent, that sort of thing. Setters, and this is true of pointers too, those two breeds are very similar in how they hunt and what the top breeders look for. They're looking for a high head. A dog that runs with a high head and scents the bird off at a distance, rather than scenting the ground, they're air scenting. This, especially in the grouse woods, is important because we have very odd wind currents and that sort of thing in the grouse woods. And with the birds being as jumpy and as hard to handle as they are, a dog generally, I've seen some that can get pretty close and pin them. But if they get close and pin them like a dog would a rooster pheasant or any kind of pheasant, 90% of the time or 95% of the time going to result in the dog bumping that bird. They have to stand off them. I mean, the typical point is, you know, 12 to 20 yards off the bird. In the wide open prairie, man, they can really scent them off from a long ways when you've got a whole covey. And, you know, a lot of times you have good wind currents in there. You really see a big difference on the prairie and how good the scenting conditions are. Even within a given day, it can change pretty dramatically.
Right.
But that's, you know, a real key part of the English setter is the high head and the mannerisms on game. And we're looking for a dog that just comes in and bang, goes on point real hard. As soon as they've got a good, you know, fix on that bird, that will pin that rough grouse. You know, they're kind of in a standoff then, right? The other thing that probably really separates English setter is the whole off switch thing, the coming in the house, even the hardest core dogs, the hardest hunting dogs coming in the house and just, you know, flopping on the couch and, you know, being, you know, pretty laid back. Rather soft, you know, affectionate breed. You know, anybody who's heavy handed training an English setter is, it's not going to work well. I mean, if you scold them, they kind of pout. They look at you like, oh God, I'm sorry. You know, it is a rather unique breed personality wise. And that's, you know, I started off with German Shorthairs. That's what my dad had. So between being a grouse hunter from the time I could drive, actually, you know, my brother took me long before I could even drive. I was hooked on that. And English setters are kind of the grouse dog. Between that and just how much I like the, you know, personality is what got us hooked on English setters.
What do you think it is, besides the high head, that makes the setter such a popular grouse dog?
Well, part of it is the physical, you know, thing of weaving through that obstacle course. They are quite fleet of foot. You know, if you look at some of the other dogs are heavier frame. If you hunt grouse a lot, if they don't get through the woods cleanly, you know, if they can't navigate that obstacle course, they'll get pretty beat up and they wear out quite quickly. So the primary thing that has made them, you know, really popular over the years, like in rough grouse trials, 2/3 of the entries are English setters, 1/3 are English pointers. And I know there isn't anything left, but if there was 1%, it would be all other breeds.
Right.
Because the attributes of those dogs fit that particular environment. You know, the honesty around game too. You know, the really good setters, you know, the whole idea is, like I said before, you know, bang, they hit that bird and stand there, do not move, do not take a step. Because on rough grouse, you know, one step and it can be over. And obviously part of that is training. You know, our ideal is a dog that just goes and does that, you know, first year, you know, puppies going out there and just innately doing that. I mean, obviously that exists to a certain degree in all breeds. That's, I suppose, what we would all, you know, hope to achieve. But the setters are particularly strong in that area, especially the, you know, what I'll call the top of the pyramid, the dogs that do come from that elite ancestry.
Can you get into the differences between the Ryman and Llewellyn setters?
A very different dog, really. George Ryman died in 1961. Even his dogs were quite different than the Ryman of today.
Okay.
The Ryman of today, you know, is a cross between a bench setter and a field setter. They're a bigger, you know, longer haired. It's a certain look dog. And the majority of them hunt at a slower pace and closer range. The Llewellyn, as I said earlier, came from a top field trial program. Percival Llewellyn he did it like all the rest of us. He went out and he got dogs from all the top breeders and created his own line. And occasionally would go out and breed, you know, to another top dog. Really, in all breeds, that's how the successful breeders have all pretty much done it. They've gone out to the other top guys and brought in, just like you're doing now. I mean, there really is no other way that's going to be real effective. That's how you do it, right? You get the best that the gene pool has to offer. So the Llewellyn is a line that they made a breed and separated it from the other English setters. Probably represents 4 or 5% of the breed. It's a very similar dog to what it was back then. There is a fair amount of variation in size in the Llewellyns, but I would say that the average, you know, female Llewellyn is 35 to 40 pounds and the average male 48 to 50, something like that. There is probably a little larger variation in what I'll just call the field setters, you know, the other. I really don't know what percentage Ryman's make up of the total breed, but of field setters, because I look at a Llewellyn as it's just another field setter line. It's a relatively small portion, you know, 5%, let's say, and the other 95% are the standard field bred dogs. But I mean, theoretically, they're the same. You know, we're all looking for the same thing, whether it be a Llewellyn or a field dog. It's just that we have a lot larger gene pool to work with, which is why, you know, I chose to use the field setters.
Admittedly, I don't know much about field trials. I haven't participated in one yet.
Field trialing gets a pretty bad rap because people look at that dog and say, well, you know, that's too much for me or whatever. But it is a selection mechanism where only the finest dog surface, you know, it's a public display, right?
It is. And it's a competition.
Right. It's judged by unbiased people, and it will identify the best in the breed. And we've bred to a lot of, you know, champions over the years, even though, you know, we're looking for an elite hunting dog.
Sure.
The way I explain it to a lot of people is to try to illustrate it. I actually wrote an article and I did an illustration. And what I did was I took a standard bell curve and then I plotted all the traits on there. Because if you think about it, a bell curve, of course, represents standard deviations. And a breeding dog, you want as many of the traits as far to the right as possible. You know, especially intelligence and stamina and biddability and trainability and all those things. Really, the only thing different that a field trialer is looking for is also extreme range, for that to be a couple standard deviations to the right. Well, if I want to get all of those traits, it's much easier for me to breed to a dog that is elite in all those. And remember, for them to be elite in there, just think, and it's a very small portion of the population, you know, one in many. How many breeders are going to look at, you know, 10 or 12 or 15 females, for example, to find one to breed, or only breed to a male that's, you know, one in 100? So that's, you see where I'm going with this, that's kind of the value of field trials, is to identify that truly elite gene pool, and it's up to the breeder to go to that and find the dogs that also produce dogs that handle easily for hunters. I mean, I've had many dogs from field trial bloodlines that were super easy to handle. I mean, they required almost no handling. So that's really important to understand. And with a lot of the social media sites, you know, the Facebook sites and that sort of thing that have discussions on this, there's more bad information sometimes than there is good. You know, as people see that trial dog and they're a little intimidated by it or whatever, and they feel the need to put it down without understanding where it really fits into the role of producing hunting dogs.
I think not all trial dogs are created equal. You may have an extremely independent, big running trial dog that is not going to be a cooperative hunting companion for a large percentage of hunters out there. I think what you're talking about is building a dog that can be a big running dog that can get out there far, but also has a more cooperative inclination or temperament towards the hunter.
Yeah. I mean, you really got right to the core of the issue here. When you're breeding to those dogs, you really have to know what you're breeding to, because some of them are just sort of on the edge and a good handler gets them around. But the really good ones are super cooperative. The best trial dog I ever had, I rarely said anything to her. I mean, judges would say, oh my God, how do you walk around here for an hour and say almost nothing to the dog? She was that cooperative. And her application was, I mean, it was like I had a joystick just putting her in all the best places. And that's what finds the most birds, dogs with superior application, which is sort, you know, good judges, that's kind of the number one thing they're looking at. How smart is that dog hunting? Because that is the dog that will produce the most birds for the gun.
Do you think that that dog was reading off of you and your body language and your direction of travel? Or was the dog smart enough to identify the targets and the wind direction and sequence those targets herself?
Well, both things happen. They absolutely, I mean, we see it even with little puppies we're starting, because on our grounds, there are certain types of cover. And in a couple of weeks, I mean, those puppies have identified where those birds are going. I mean, they learn that quickly. And so why the dog's out there? I mean, that's one of the top things we look at in terms of selection for breeding, is the dog that just absolutely identifies all those spots and works their way through the cover. But given I'm primarily a rough grouse hunter, those dogs really have to track you. I mean, because you can't see past 30 yards.
Right.
So if they want to track you, you're in real trouble. And the dog that I was just referring to, the field trial dog, one time when I was on the prairie in real rolling country, I wanted to see exactly what she would do. So I had a Garmin on her, right? A GPS. And I hid behind a hill. And I just watched on the GPS as she sucked in. And as she got close, I just popped my head up above and right back to it she went. She just sort of hunted her way back until she knew where I was. And like in a horseback trial, when those guys turn a horse, now I've only ran in it, you know, I've run in a few horseback trials, but I've judged quite a few. They turn that horse and the dog turns with them. Now, anybody can handle a dog at 50 yards or 100 yards. The reason that they push those dogs out, they're pushing it to an extreme. It's an extreme test. They are literally looking to make most dogs fail. And so if somebody goes to a trial and they observe, they say, what they notice is the dogs that fail without recognizing, well, it's kind of set up that if the dog doesn't really have all the tools and isn't super cooperative and, you know, ultra athletic, they're, you know, they just don't make that grade.
So how and when do you determine when a dog is going to make the grade to stay as part of your breeding stock in the kennel?
You know, every breeder approaches that a little bit different. Our situation is very unique in that we have the facilities we do, and we evaluate 30 dogs a year for breeding, which, you know, most breeders, you know, probably evaluate one or two. And we look at, on average, a dozen females to find one to breed. So our process is pretty unique in that if we look at 30, after they go through the bird and gun intro, we start them very young. I mean, literally last week I put a 10-week-old puppy on birds and she was pointing birds. But by 6 to 7 months, we've kind of made our initial evaluation. We see the ones that demonstrate the greatest intelligence, the most biddability, the best natural manners around game. And then we'll cut 2/3 of them because we can't take 30 dogs and put them on wild birds. So to make a sports analogy for basketball fans, we're looking for the McDonald's All-Americans. And then we'll take those 10 on and evaluate them through a hunting season. Then those will get cut down to, you know, half of them, you know, 4 or 5, something like that. And then they go through another whole season where we break them steady to wing and shot. And I don't trial anymore, so I don't even, with most of them, bother to keep them steady to wing and shot. But we want to see that they take that process and train all the way through that. Again, you know, an extreme test, just like field trials are an extreme test. And then they'll go through the second season. And at that point, we'll make a determination, are they ready to breed? Or are they dogs that are worthy of breeding?
You keep all your puppies initially with the intent to breed them and then cull them through your process, or selling some to puppy buyers young and keeping a few out of that?
Yeah, we keep two or three out of most, well, we keep two out of every litter and sometimes three. To that, we'll get 30 a year that we're evaluating. And then the ones that are cut at 6 or 7 months are sold as started dogs. And then we go on with the others.
Have you guys always done this in your breeding program, or how did you start? Did you start out more like the rest of us breeders?
We always, because my brother worked, my dad built Edge Netler's Kennel, who put 2 red setters in the Field Trial Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow.
And my brother worked for him. So he grew up, you know, learning the right ways to do this. You know, early on, you know, we probably evaluated, you know, 7 or 8 dogs a year. And, you know, it grew throughout the years as our facilities grew and that sort of thing. And then when Ben made our hobby a business, then we, you know, were evaluating lots and lots of dogs.
That's pretty impressive. When I think about my kennel, which is a young kennel, I'm still working on my A litter, but I still have a good understanding of what my methodology is going to be for how I breed. But these are numbers that I can't even fathom, because, you know, I'm talking about having 2 litters a year for for the next 2 years, and then I might get up to 4 litters a year, partly because there just aren't that many small Munsterlanders out there, and we can't just breed all of them, right? Also partly because I can't imagine just starting with 30 dogs in the kennel and just taking off running.
Yeah, our situation is really unique. I mean, the vast majority of English Setter breeders in the United States are people with, you know, 4 or 5 dogs in the house, you know, which requires some devotion, right? Or they have, you know, a building like I do. So the main kennel's at Ben's place. I have a 10-stall kennel here. And I think that that is pretty representative of a lot of hobbyist breeders that have 5, 6, 7, 8 dogs, you know, and have a couple litters a year. I mean, I think that is the percentage of breeders that do it in scale is just tiny. It's not a good business model. I mean, the pros, you know, the pros either, well, they train and they board for the public. That's really where they make their living. Some of them guide, you know, that sort of thing. It's changing a little bit because there hasn't been as the flood on the market. You know, I mean, in the popular breeds, you know, Brittany short hair, that sort of thing. I might be wrong about this, but it sure seems to me like over the last 10 or 20 years, there are less people willing to go through the effort to produce litters, you know, hobbyists. And it's also kind of a lifestyle, you know, where they're, you know, you're pretty devoted to the dogs. As you know, when you have puppies around and whatnot, right? You're not going anywhere. You know, no. You'd be there to take care of the puppies, that sort of thing. Because there are less hobbyists producing them, there are probably a few more pros that are, you know, producing dogs now. Because, you know, what I remember, you know, 20 years ago was professional trainers might have a litter or two, but that, you know, that was it. I mean, their business was training and boarding for the public for the most part. So see a little bit of difference there, but the top breeders now in any breed, whether it be the popular breeds or the more minority breeds like you have, you know, have a very long waiting list. Well, and the other thing that's changed is social media like this, podcasts and websites and whatnot, educating the public. So there's no secrets. You know, the people that are producing the best dogs are well known.
What I like about this, what I like about podcasting, what I like about social media is actually building this network. I learn a ton from guests like you every time I record a podcast, and then I get to listen to it again when I edit it. So it really gets driven in. Selfishly, that's part of the reason that I'm doing this. Another reason that I'm doing it is because if I can get a guy like you who's been doing this as long as you have to share his knowledge, and I can get 500 people to listen to it, the whole dog breeding and dog training community benefits from that.
Yeah, I really do like podcasts. Other forms of, you know, bulletin boards and that sort of thing almost foster a lot of bad information.
Everybody's an expert.
Yeah. And I mean, in the context of everybody should have a say and do it for fun and, you know, all that on those kinds of sites, great. But so often I'll see, you know, what is kind of presented as an expert position by, you know, somebody that just, I mean, pros, you know, like my brother, or, you know, I mean, I've worked and field trialed and hunted and trained with lots of top pros from all over the country. I mean, they devote their life to this. They've seen so many dogs that, I mean, even somebody who's like a serious hunter just can't possibly have seen what they've seen.
Sure.
So doing podcasts with, you know, those kinds of people, I mean, this has been, you know, a lifestyle for me. And so I've learned from going around the country and training and trialing with a lot of these, you know, top guys. And it's just, as you say, it's a fountain of information.
Can you think of any notable Berg Brothers setters that you've had over the last 30 years?
Well, we've sold a number of dogs that, you know, people trialed in every kind of venue you can imagine, you know, from national shoot to retrieve, cover dog trials, walking trials, horseback trials, you know, all that. We've had a number of champions in all of those venues. We had a dog, Berg Brothers Jack, that kind of changed the course of our history. He was just a phenomenal producer. And if I think about the best dogs that we've ever had, the thing that really stands out, we call it mental makeup. And it, all those things. So biddability, trainability, but, you know, application and composure and just that focus, those are all traits we would lump into mental makeup. And this dog was like a human. It was just weird. It's hard to even describe. This dog in the house, people would literally say, does that dog hunt? He was an absolute couch potato. But when you turned him loose, and, you know, for the people, for your listeners who are thinking, you know, who don't really know a lot about setters and are thinking, is this a breed for me? It's hard to beat them as a companion. They're just so, you know, affectionate and engaging and all that. You know, the top of the breed, you know, what we're talking about here, hunt really hard. It's like they call it the light switch. You know, boom, you take them out and they go. And one of those variations I was talking about is what I call pace. And not a lot of people talk about pace, but how hard, how far does that dog go? And different people are comfortable with a different range and a different pace. I can tell you what is the most effective. I mean, my background is analytics, so I look at it purely, and my brother is very much this way as well. We don't have personal preferences. What is the most functional or productive is how we look at it. What traits will find and produce the most pointed birds? Some of the trial dogs just, they go harder than what I want. You know, they'll burn themselves up. I go on a lot of, you know, 2 to even 3 hour walks. I go real deep in the woods at times, you know, to get back to areas that I want to check out. I want that dog to be strong at the end of a 2 or 3 hour hunt. And a dog that hits the ground that hard, that's not going to be the case. So where I was going with this is that is one of the great, you know, variations among setters. And, you know, as your listeners, you know, go out and say, what's the right English setter for me? That's one of the things that they really kind of need to nail down with any given breeder because of the variability that exists.
Pace is such an important thing to me. I'm really glad you brought that up because right now I only have 2 dogs. And when I hunt, I'm going to go hunt all day. I might get back to the tailgate to make a sandwich and I'm going back out. If I'm going to run 2 dogs at the same time, I need dogs that are capable of hunting for 8 hours.
It's often overlooked. I mean, a lot of people don't hunt all day. But for anybody that wants to, you know, put in a pretty hard day, I mean, I carry 8 dogs when I'm hunting. But when I shoot my limit, the gun goes in the truck and I never quit. I mean, right. I've always got young dogs I want to work. So, you know, my buddies are the same way. I mean, when the three of us like go to the prairie, we're carrying 24 dogs. We all drive our own vehicles because we have to have vehicles to carry that many dogs. And we never, ever quit. So, yeah. And I mean, I'm sure that there are plenty of other people that there's a lot of people that travel to hunt now. And if you've driven 8 or 12 or 16 hours, you know, to go hunt, boy, that ought to be a prime consideration in the dog that you select, and that it have the athleticism and stamina. We see an awful lot of dogs that just physically aren't that good. And the gait comes into, you know, how smooth the gait is. We sell a lot of dogs out west to those guys that hunt big country in that hard country. And if a dog is hitting the ground hard, man, that's going to be hard on them. You need a dog that kind of floats over that. The grouse woods is entirely different, in that they're basically running through an obstacle course. And so they have to be fleet of foot. They have to be able to kind of glide through all that all without beating themselves up and without completely wearing themselves out.
So you're going to put me up on my soapbox for a second and talking about structure and conformation and why that is so important when you're breeding hunting dogs. I could give you a dog with a great nose, with a tremendous amount of drive, that's poor in structure, and you're going to love that dog for 4 years. But sometime when that dog really starts to mature and put on some size, if it's poor in structure, it's not going to be a healthy hunting dog, and it's just not going to hunt for you for 12 years.
Yeah, no doubt. They're going to break down. I mean, most people have 1 or 2 dogs, so they need to be able to get as many hours as possible. But for a dog whose pace is so slow as to be unproductive, personally, I can't stand to watch that, because when I'm looking at it, all I'm thinking is, that dog's not going to find very many birds. And I've seen now a dog with kind of ideal pace, that strong, you know, I call it kind of a three-quarter pace, but they can just keep going at that. Those dogs will badly outbird, you know, that very slow-paced dog. But, you know, if you're somebody with one dog and you're going to go travel, you know, out of state, do you want a dog that can only hunt an hour and a half a day? You know, maybe for them, a slow-paced dog is the right choice. I guess all we can ask is that people go into it, or all what we can provide is an education into how can they find that right dog, and, you know, how do you identify? That's the other thing. It's not that obvious what is an ideal structure. You know, I mean, how many people are really going to pay that much attention to that? You know, I mean, of the hunting public.
Oh, none of the hunting public, because we don't know what to look for. I think there are very few people that can identify what a properly structured 8-week-old puppy is.
Well, I always tell people, you look at the parents. At 8 or 9 weeks, they are kind of a small version of their adult self. And you can look at bone densities and the height to length ratio and all that and get a pretty good idea. But there are so many other attributes, you know, those mental attributes we talked about, and the right bird, you know, handling game and all those things. So I always tell people, man, if you're looking at a puppy, you're looking at the wrong thing. You should be looking at the parents and the ancestry.
So you and I were talking about Setters Unlimited, and the, is it a database that you built that's the backbone for the website?
No, all I did was it's an invite only site where I invited top breeders to participate. And, you know, 25 years ago, it was really quite different. It was a lot of people evaluating a lot of dogs like we were, and there's so few of them around anymore that I had to kind of change the criteria a little bit. What I did was find kind of different types of dogs and guys that were still very skilled, very selective, you know, and have a reputation for producing a great product. And they're simply listed on the site. All of their individual sites are on the main site. So if somebody goes to the main site and they go, oh, I want to look at XYZ kennel, they just click on their kennel, on their link, and go to their website. And there's some other, you know, information about, you know, how do you pick an English setter and what are the, you know, the attributes, and, you know, more educational type stuff about English setters.
If somebody's looking for information about English setters, or they think that that's a breed that they might be interested in, Setters Unlimited is almost the one-stop shop where you can learn about the dogs, their size, their, you know, requirements, temperament. You have an opportunity to find some breeders and call through those, contact them and everything. And then you also have litters posted on there, right?
There are some. The best way to do it is definitely to go to the individual sites. But you're right. That's how I set it up. If somebody was interested in getting a setter from a very top breeder, they could go there and shop amongst several breeders and look at their sites and pick two or three that they wanted to talk to, or however they wanted to do it. But it does make it quite easy for somebody who doesn't, you know, follow this and already know who, you know, who the top breeders are. That's what I was thinking when I did it. Man, if I decide, oh, you know, I went hunting with somebody and they had a setter and I really like the dog, or, you know, I like the temperament or whatever. If you're not a follower of English setters, how would you know how to find the top breeders? Because remember back then when I did this 25 years ago, everybody had a website. And if you looked at those websites, everybody claimed to be, you know, have the best dogs on the planet, right? So, man, as a consumer, how do you sort that out? It's actually even harder today because most of them don't have websites. So how do you learn about them? You know, you go to their Facebook site, and that's just not an adequate medium to explain a breeding program. You know, there's it's just completely inadequate. So we have less information, oddly enough, than we did 25 years ago.
I looked through it prior to coming on here, and I'm, you know, really interested in talking to you and seeing how we can incorporate that in the small Munsterlander world.
It's got great possibilities for any breed. It's just a matter of how you set it up to be the most functional.
Scott, I'm going to give you a chance to maybe give us some closing thoughts, if you would, please.
Well, for those who, you know, don't really know this breed, try to get out, you know, to a handful of different breeders and see them on birds, see them in person, and see if it does fit what you want personality wise. Because I think that is one of the real strong points of the breed, is that they're a great companion dog. They're so in tune to people, and they so do want to please. But if you go to the, you know, again, what I'm going to call the field line of setters, there is enough variance. You can kind of go find whatever you want, whatever size, whatever look. The biggest variance is, you know, probably the range and how hard the dogs hunt. Shouldn't say the biggest variance, the biggest variance amongst people's preferences. And so that's one of the things to tune in to as people go out and shop, you know, the breed, trying to find what fits for them, is to understand that part of it. Understand how much dog, you know, can you handle? How much dog do you want? And there is a little bit of a misnomer about, you know, kind of the trial bred dogs, because there are plenty of them that are super easy to handle. You just have to find a breeder who is selective enough in what they're breeding to find those dogs that have all those attributes, you know, of the trial type dogs, but have selected for dogs that are, you know, easier to handle.
And you can find all that information on Setters Unlimited.
Yes, those breeders are a real good place to start.
Where can people go to find you if they wanted to contact you directly?
We have a site, you know, we're connected to Setters Unlimited as well, but anybody who Googles English Setters or English Setter Breeders will be the first or second one that pops up. So it's not hard to find us.
Excellent. And you guys are Bird Brothers Setters.
Correct.
Scott, thanks so much for being on. I appreciate you dropping knowledge on me, and I'm sure the listeners do too.
Happy to do it. Thanks, Bill.
I hope you enjoyed episode number 7 of the Woe Post. Remember, you can always contact me, Facebook or Instagram, at the Woe Post, or bill@thewoepost.com on email. If you'd like to support the podcast, share it with a friend. If you'd like to support it even more, head over to patreon.com/thewoepost and become a patron. Stay steady, and God bless.